Welcome to St. Mark's Cathedral Conversations, a podcast featuring members of the St. Mark's Cathedral community in Seattle, Washington. These interviews feature lives of faith and adventure, service and connection. Here's our host, Michael Pereira.
St. Mark's Cathedral, this is Pat. How may I help you?
Pat, tell us where we are.
We're at St. Mark's Cathedral in the office suite on the main floor, but opposite the elevator, and we are specifically located at what is known as front desk, one word.
And what is going on today? There's a lot of activity here.
This is the week of choir camp. We have children from throughout the diocese, something like 40 or 50, learning to sing together, to place their voices in the fronts of their faces, in the classic Anglican way, and also visiting sites of interest like Macaw Hall, where music is produced.
You mentioned the classical Anglican way, and I guess that's a good segue into the start of our conversation, which will be how you found St. Mark's, how you found the Episcopal Church. Can you start us off on that journey?
My parents, my grandparents, my ancestors were Anglicans from the time of the Elizabethan settlement, so I did not find the Episcopal Church. I was in it. And as far as St. Mark's is concerned, when we came to this diocese in the 60s, we said, where is the cathedral? Because you need to know where your cathedral is.
Of course. Do you remember the dean of the cathedral at that time?
Dean Leffler.
Oh, John Leffler.
Yes.
What was St. Mark's of the 60s like?
Oh, it had an enormous great pulpit that sat on the south side, southwest side. I remember preaching in it when I was a deacon. It's like being in the prow of a big boat, and you had to go upstairs to get to it. It was dark in the cathedral, and lots of dark wood, and the organ was sitting just about over the pulpit, I think. And the choir had to sit in the front, not in the gallery. It was an old-fashioned church then.
What was your first impression? I'm sure physically the building has changed a lot.
My first impression was that I was very clumsy, because the first time we came here was a special service. I was, in those days, wearing high heels, and I stepped on a gentleman's instep. My children were shocked and horrified. My husband looked the other way, and I was covered in shame.
Do you remember the gentleman's reaction?
He was covered in pain.
I always ask that question, what was your first impression? But it sounds like you made quite an impression as well.
I'm afraid so.
Tell us about your rise through the clergy.
Oh, dear. Well, I was turned down 3 times for ordination, and Bishop Cochran told me when it would be a good time to come back and try again, and then they said, okay, you can be a deacon.
That sounds like a fairly straightforward resolution.
Well, then I came. Then they said, no, you're not really a deacon. A lot of priests said, you're really a priest. So they switched me from deacon to priest.
Does that happen very often?
No. Happened to Marta Stedman Sandberg.
Canon for the Ordinary.
Yes, who was a deacon when I was, and we were both priested together.
That's a lovely little pairing, that you both started off as deacons, and then your switch to priesthood happened at the same time?
Yes. And now we're both called canon.
For those who are unaware, tell us what that word canon means. We do see it a lot.
Well, canon actually means a rule. The reason some clergy are called canon is because they work for either the diocese or the a cathedral, and is kind of a standard setter. Mm-hmm. We look to the cathedral to be the standard setter for liturgy in a diocese, and that's why they call the clergy of the cathedral canons, I guess, because we don't make the rules, but we have to keep them.
That's fair. That also ties into a question I had. So you said you, when you came to the Seattle area, you looked for the Episcopal Cathedral, the Anglican Cathedral. Mm-hmm. That's where you wanted to be. What kept you here?
Oh, no, we only looked for the cathedral because we needed to know where the cathedral was. We had to find out which was our parish first.
Oh, of course. So what was that like?
Because when we came here, we were used to having assigned parishes, and it was a shock to find that you could go to any church you wanted to.
So that's the difference between the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church of Canada?
I'm not sure it's still the difference, but okay. It was at that point.
I see.
The difference. Called the diocese, and they said, you can go to any church you want. Here's the cathedral next door.
I'm sure that made things easier.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the choice. You presumably checked out St. Mark's because it was convenient. What encouraged you to remain?
But even at that, we didn't come here for our parish.
Oh, so where'd you go?
We went first to Christ Church because we lived near there. Then we went to St. David, which is now St. David Emmanuel, because we moved out there.
And where is that?
Shoreline. And we came here for festivals and big deals and Cathedral Day.
And then how did this become your parish?
I came here to hide after I retired. I thought there'd be so many people that I wouldn't get caught to do anything.
And how did that work out?
It didn't work out.
Why clergy? I mean, you talked about how deeply this goes back for your family, but what is it about being in clergy, being a member of the priesthood that speaks to you?
Huh. Do you want me to tell you the story about how I got put in the psychiatrist's caseload?
Well, now you know we have to.
When I was a young woman in high school in the 40s, they instituted at my school something called vocational guidance. And the first session of vocational guidance was everybody could say what they really wanted to be when they got out of school and grew up. And I thought they're going to let us say teacher or stenographer or nurse because we were all girls. But the first girl who spoke, I won't say her name in case she's still alive, said she was going to be a doctor. And I thought that's really odd because I do her math for her, so she'll pass. But nobody laughed, and the teacher wrote it down and took it seriously. And we went on down the rows, and we were getting closer to me, and I'm thinking, maybe this is a real story. We can make it some... What would I really like to be? And then Elaine, somebody or other, who was 4'11" and built like an egg, said that she was going to be a model. And nobody laughed, and the teacher wrote it down in the book. So I thought, I would like to be like my Uncle John, because I like what my Uncle John does. My Uncle John is a priest. So when it came to me, I said, I would like to be a priest. And the shock and horror, they thought I didn't know I was a girl. And I spent 3 months being interviewed by psychologists and psychiatrists to see if I really knew my gender.
Because you said priest.
Mm-hmm. And everybody knows in those days that you can't be a priest if you're a woman. And if you think you can be a priest, maybe you don't know you're a woman.
What was the outcome of the psychiatric evaluations?
I got back into class and nobody said anything.
Your family must have been so amused by that because being in the priesthood was part of their tradition.
My family was not amused. They were very, very... traditional people, and they knew perfectly well you couldn't be a priest if you were a woman. And I should have known, too. Uncle John is the only one who was amused.
it's nice that we can look back on this now with hindsight and humor, but I imagine it caused a bit of a stir.
It caused a stir. I also had to report to my parish priest to be explained to me why women couldn't be priests.
Why did you persist?
My father was Irish.
That's compelling. That's very compelling.
We're stubborn. No, I went into school teaching, and then later on I became a nurse. But always in the back of my mind was, there's some unfinished business here. And I used to dream that a voice was saying, you're doing fine, but that's not what I asked you to do.
When did you start your official journey of ordination?
Oh, it must have been during the 70s. Women could be ordained deacon then.
Mm-hmm.
And the shock of when I found women could be ordained a priest, it was a shock because I said, okay, now I'm going to have to follow through. Oh, no more excuses.
Yeah. The door was open.
Yeah.
And was this here in the States? Or
was we were here.
Do you remember your feelings when your ordination was complete and you were fully ordained?
I had no feet.
What do you mean?
I was again in high heels.
You in high heels?
Yes, and my feet. At the beginning of the ordination service, my feet were hurting like the devil. By the time the bishop had laid hands on me and I was up at the altar, I didn't have any feet. I did not know I had feet. I couldn't feel them at all.
That's a memory that would stay with you, I'm sure.
Uh-huh. Yep. That's what you get for sticking your neck out. Your feet.
Tell us about some of the things that you do here at St. Mark's.
Oh, I answer the phone on Wednesdays. I have until recently been the registrar for this choir school, which means I've had lots of opportunity to play with children.
Mm-hmm.
I have done support groups for dementia and grieving. And I still meet with people who have demented spouses or who are in the early stages of grieving. We talk about this and that and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I work on Wednesdays is in case the person who's scheduled to do the noon Eucharist doesn't show up or gets sick or gets caught in traffic, I'm here and can go and do it. I do funerals sometimes, got one on the books coming up pretty soon, and I assist with bread at a number of services. Seems because I'm close, I seem to be on duty a lot. I teach Bible study when it's my turn, and sometimes I come to special services just to say hello to the folk that are coming in the door that aren't really members of St. Mark's, but are just attending, and say welcome to them. I don't know, what else do I do, Michael? You see me running around.
I only know the tip of the iceberg, and that's why we're here. Everybody's such a deep iceberg, which is a strange metaphor. But if we don't know that, if we don't acknowledge that, then I think we are missing out on the core of what makes us a community.
Right now I'm doing some work for the Children and Family Ministry. So I'm preparing the Sunday activity bags, which I did for 3 years before Kelly came, and now I'm doing it again, which means filling their little handbags with crayons and drawing paper and a little book and a Sunday school paper and changing those every week to make sure that they have their supplies. Also, it seems to me that I made all these bags except two.
Well, you're very close.
Because the bags keep walking home with the children, and we need to make new ones.
Yes. I imagine they don't walk back.
I seldom walk back, but I'm going to have some fabric given to me. I've used all my scrap.
You mentioned how you came to St. Mark's looking for a bit of anonymity from your other parish. And yet, you do all of these things that help so many people on so many different levels. Why?
There's a prayer in the New Zealand prayer book, and it has in it a phrase, something about that we may be faithful and hopeful and useful to the end of our days. And the useful part fills in a lot that I need in my life. To be needed, to be occupied, to feel that I'm contributing. And it's a way of saying thank you to God and to the congregation for my close family.
I like family. The word community has many strengths to it, but family has a unique power. And to be a part of the family, to be a contributing part of the family, that's a good feeling. That's a very strong feeling.
It is. Yep.
How has your time here at St. Mark's changed you?
You mean apart from the fact that I'm getting old?
I said nothing of that kind.
How has it changed me? It's tied me to Seattle. I might have been tempted after two elections, different elections, to return to Canada, but since I have family here other than my blood relatives, I stayed. If you have to suffer, so do I.
Suffering together is what family does.
Yes. So I didn't desert.
How have you seen this parish change over the years you've been here?
Oh, it's a much healthier parish now than it was when I first came. Well, I came here when I retired. I think I was 70 at the time. And there was a time of tumult. Things were unhappy. They are much happier and stronger and healthier and more outgoing now. The parish is not gazing at its navel, it's gazing at the community around us, engaging in a healthy way.
What do you think the parish sees when it gazes at the community?
Need, room for engagement, jobs to be done, justice to be sought, God's work to do.
You talked about how much this place has changed in the time you've been here. Looking to the future, into your own crystal ball, where do you see us being led? How do you see God calling us to the next generation?
Well, I think we will continue to be what some people call the light on the hill, involved with justice and mercy. I think we may be a singular beacon. I think parishes are going to get smaller. The church is going to get smaller, but I think the cathedral, both by its physical presence and by the fact that it has a lot more people than most parishes, will continue to be a witness to God's involvement in the world.
I like that. Smaller, perhaps, but stronger in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Just to pull the focus back a little bit, you talked about how we will continue to be a light on the hill. And even the physical presence of the cathedral is recognized by many in the city. They may not know the word Episcopalian or anything about us, but they see the box, they see the big window, and they know that there's a church there, and hopefully that this church is doing some good. How have you seen the city of Seattle and the community of Seattle change as well?
Sturdy.
Yep.
I don't go downtown anymore because there are holes in the pavement. You have to keep crossing the street because people are building things. Everything. Because I'm old, I say, everything is changing. Nothing is staying the same. It's too much change. We have change fatigue.
That was remarkable. I kind of want to do the whole interview now in that voice, but we'll move on.
Oh, Seattle's all right. It's just that when you get old, you kind of like things to stay the same. And they're not going to stay the same. They can't.
What's one of your enduring memories of St. Mark? Something that made an impression on you, and it could have been yesterday, it could have been your first day here, that solidified why this is a place you feel called to be here and to serve in the capacities that you do.
Dean Leffler taught me preaching. Before I was a member of this congregation, he explained about his doubts about the Flintrop organ. He'd been away and came back, and the pieces of the Flintrop were lying all over the floor of the nave. And he said he felt terribly discouraged because nothing could ever go right. They couldn't possibly sort that out. He went home to prepare his sermon for Sunday, and one of the readings said, "Can these bones live?" And he realized that, yes, all those bones of organ on the floor could live. So to me, that was a sign of life in the cathedral. And it's been a kind of beacon. Yes, these bones can live, even when we're in difficulties, when the budget isn't right. Even in those times, yes, these bones can live. And it's a sign of hope for me, going back to Dean Leffler and his resurgence of hope. Did that answer your question, or did that raise another question?
Both. It certainly did answer it, that at a time when the cathedral was struggling, there was such a clear sign, to use your word, that the struggle is a part of who we are. It's a part of life, and there is still life in that. It's not a symbol of decay or destruction, but we can still live in that and live beyond that as well.
And when we see the flame drop, yes, those bones are alive.
Oh, yes. There have been so many people I've talked to recording these podcasts where they've said that sometimes their first impression of St. Mark's was looking up and seeing that organ, the size and the scale of it, or coming here for a service or a recital and then feeling it in their bones.
Mm-hmm. That's another thing I like about the cathedral's fabric. When I look up at the ceiling and think that the wood on the ceiling was the forms of the wall, and that is so economically sound. It makes sense to reuse those boards.
What does it tell you that we did that?
That the people who began the cathedral had good common sense. They didn't have good common sense according to the drawing in the Thompson Chapel, but when it came down to really doing stuff, they got it together.
So maybe their ambition was a little bit beyond scale, but the resources that they had,
they used them well.
Do you think we're still living into that sense of the bones being alive?
Oh, yes. Just look at the renovations we've been doing. And we're not finished yet. They're going to dig a hole in the floor to make a font.
I wish people could see the look on your face.
I'm so afraid that somebody's going to fall in it.
And, of course, as we speak, the labyrinth is being constructed and the walkway outside.
Yes, it is. Yes, another place to fall over. I'm just wondering where the body of the font will end up. I mean, if it's going to be under the floor, I want to see down there first. I don't want it to end up in, say, Glenn's office. Oh. Or the men's room.
Yeah, this cathedral has certainly seen a lot. I've only been here for a little under 3 years, I think. And it's tough for me to remember a time when renovation or improvement was not being discussed, which in some ways is good. This is a place that moves forward, and it does mean things would have to change.
Well, one of the problems during the times of the Troubles, that's an Irish phrase, was that we were not doing maintenance. Things were falling apart, not only spiritually, but physically. They go together sometimes. Various kinds of health,
sure,
help one another.
Yeah. And you see us in a better place now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
I think if somebody with your perspective and if your experience can so easily answer that question, it does bode well for us. We're not going to sit on our laurels, obviously.
Better not.
Yes, well, I mean, we had better not. Otherwise, we're
they'll
just
turn
repeating
to compost under you.
And we'll be repeating history.
Yes.
We'll be making those same mistakes again.
Right. But right. We have to keep up. Every church I've served in has had to have its roof fixed.
What does that tell us about you, Pat?
Well, it told us a lot about flat roof churches.
Church architecture, that's a thing.
Yes, right. It also taught me that when I went to a parish, I needed to, and I was responsible for any part of it, I needed quickly to see where in the last maintenance was done.
All the more reason for you never to leave us, Pat. I think we can draw a straight line between you coming to St. Mark's and things slowly but surely getting better.
Oh, come now. That's giving me too much credit. I just come in and ride on the coattails of other people and cheer.
Step on their feet, apparently.
And step on their feet and cheer. That's part of my job, is being a cheerleader.
Is there a canon for cheerleading? I mean, there could be now.
I think there is a... I think that's a diaconal service.
Yeah,
it's left over from my being a deacon. Telling people, yes, it's... Yeah, you're doing a great job. Thank you. It's... Couldn't manage without you. Mm. And would you please add this to your portfolio?
Spoken like a true deacon. I mean, we could take you out of the diaconate, but we could never take the diaconate out of you.
No, I'm afraid not. It goes along with being a woman.
And on
and
that
a
note,
mother.
Oh, I'm sure there are so many more stories there, but we'll have to leave those for another podcast, because on that note, Pat Taylor, thank you so much for sharing so many things with us. I've been looking forward to sitting down with you and talking about how this got started, what this means for you, somebody who is, as you said, the linchpin of this cathedral.
No, that was a joke.
Which I'm taking very seriously. And I'm sure many of our listeners will agree. So as we leave the front desk, just to say again, thank you so much, Pat, for being a part of this and for adding your voice to our story.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for coming here.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. Our music was performed by Michael Kleinschmidt on the Flintrop organ at St. Mark's. Michael Pereira and Andrew Himes produced the podcast, and we hope you'll visit stmarks.org. So long.